This is the Museum of Lost Objects on BBC Radio 4. We've been telling you the stories of antiquities or cultural sites that have been destroyed or looted in Iraq and Syria. In this last episode, we're going back to 2003 and the looting of the Iraq Museum in Baghdad.
Ah, it was terrible. You didn't want to believe it. And especially when you started hearing objects that you know, I will say that you talk to from time to time, and you know, you had some kind of relation to some of these objects. And then they start saying they've gone. Yeah, it was a shock.
This is Iraqi archaeologist Lamia Al-Gilani. She once worked at the Iraq Museum and helped to document its vast collection of ancient cylinder seals. These seals were the ancient Near East's way of stamping or signing documents. But don't think for a moment that these are mundane objects. Each seal was carved all over with pictures that told a story. Back in 2003, almost the entire collection was lost, and it's still never been found.
5,000 of nearly 7,000 has disappeared.
In April 2003, as American tanks rolled into Baghdad, in the chaos spawned by the invasion, the museum was broken into and pillaged.
One of the most depressing sights after the fall of Saddam Hussein was the looting of the museums of Iraq. Thousands of...
Where's the American? Where's the American? This is how Iraq wants to be. Everybody's stealing and looting from everybody. We want secure, we want peace for our country.
To move from a repressed dictatorial regime to something that's freer, we've seen in that transition period there's untidiness.
Looters rampaged through its halls, storerooms and cellars, stealing upwards of 15,000 precious objects. Its ransacking was symbolic of the upheaval and chaos that still roils many parts of Iraq.
No one was caught because of the museum looting. No one. Not a single person.
So the last piece we're placing in our Museum of Lost Objects is one of these missing cylinder seals. It was also one of Lamia's favourites. It was found in a place called Hamrin, north of Baghdad. And it shows a harvest festival. At 4,600 years old, it's the oldest object in our series. And at 3.9 centimetres high, it's also the smallest. It could neatly fit in the palm of your hand. And when it was rolled across a slab of wet clay, the seal would leave the rich impression of a narrative. Our harvest seal conjured a grand scene of abundance and reverence. And its central character was a female goddess so powerful and respected that she made her throne out of a man.
It shows you such a lot of story in it. It is a festival, a harvest festival. There is the goddess, and the goddess must be an agricultural goddess. There is a tree branch part of her crown. She is even sitting, and her chair is a man with a branch in his hand. You see what I mean? An attendant, she's sitting on him. This is really very unique. You don't see that often. And then you have in front of her a row of four men in a boat. So they are traveling by river coming to the festival. There's a goat there, you know, the property of the temple or the produce. And at the bottom, there are men putting the agricultural produce on a big pile in front of the goddess.
These were scenes of farming and fertility, of the working of the earth and the worship of its goddess. Mesopotamia produced some of the world's earliest cities, but rural life was still central to its society. A bond we see clearly in the harvest seal.
It's fantastic. I mean, it gives you a whole story. Some of these cylinder seals, right through, they give you stories. It's not only a piece of art. Yeah, maybe all my years in the museum, the 8 years, most of my work was making impressions of these cylinder seals.
The Iraq Museum housed some of the most spectacular Mesopotamian artifacts ever discovered. It's Iraq's biggest and most important museum. It was founded in 1922 and it moved through several reincarnations. It changed names and even locations, but from the start, it's been a key part of Iraq's modern national identity. The nation-state of Iraq was an invention of the 20th century, but one of the things that helped distinguish this fledgling country was its rich and unique cultural history. The museum in Baghdad kept those treasures. It held Iraq's sense of itself.
So I'm one of the last few Iraqi archaeologists who have lived in the old museum and the new museum.
Lamia is based in London now, but she worked in Baghdad and remembers the original home of the museum.
You see, the people in the museum now has hardly any idea how it was before. It was lovely because it was in the middle of the bazaar. And so the type of visitors we had then was completely different from the new museum. We used to get old women in their abaya, you know, wearing their black cloak with their baskets. And my room was at the top of the stairs, so I could see them talking and coming up and so on. It was one of the nicest things to see ordinary people who wanted to come and look around.
Lamia worked at the Iraq Museum in the 60s, and it was in 1966 when the museum moved to its current home. Her boss then was a man called Fuad Safar, who was one of Iraq's first archaeologists. He died in the 70s, but his son Mazin remembers how hard he worked when the museum opened its new headquarters.
Building the collection for the Iraqi museum became my father's life obsession. And he would spend all his time digging in the basement, bringing things, writing about what they are and putting them all in place.
Mazin's father worked long hours and would basically forget to eat. So Mazin, under tight instructions from his mother, had the task of delivering lunch to his overworked dad.
So I was a kid on a bicycle going across the city to the museum and go searching for him, which gallery, where is he, and then have him sit and eat and bring the food back. And my mother used to say, don't come back empty-handed, bring these containers back. That was her way of making sure that he eats.
And then Mazin would inevitably get roped in.
I worked there as a boy, making maps and making signs for some of the artifacts, and enjoyed it. I recognized the footprints of that museum like my apartment, because I spent so many hours and so many days in that place. I know it very well.
News of the 2003 looting may have stunned the world, but it really hit home for Mazin.
Immediately the image of my father came to mind, and I thank God that he had passed away before he could see all of this happening. He would have heartbroken multiple times, and it would have been devastating for him.
When the museum was broken into, its staff had to fend off the looters. The Americans had provided no protection. And it seems it was only on the insistence of the British Museum in London that soldiers were sent to guard the building. John Curtis was the keeper of the Middle East collection at the British Museum at the time, and he and director Neil McGregor were instrumental in making this happen.
Neil McGregor got in contact with Number 10, and they urged the White House to send tanks and so on to protect the museum as soon as possible. And actually the tanks were then put in position later that day.
They were some of the first Westerners to enter the museum.
Nobody had been in since the tanks had arrived, but they opened the gates and allowed us to go in. And we parked in the museum forecourt and actually slept the night there on the colonnade outside the main door. Even when we went there, there was still gunfire to be heard going on all around. An American armoured division with their tanks can drive to the centre of Baghdad and say, we've captured Baghdad, but in a sense they haven't, because obviously there's still a lot of resistance going on all around. So, yeah, OK, you drive your tanks to the middle of Baghdad, but you haven't really established order in the city, and that's what they hadn't done. It was an appalling sight inside the museum, and a lot of it was just gratuitous violence. You know, cases have been smashed and broken, even when they didn't have anything in them, for no good reason. There was clearly a great deal of resentment on the part of the local populace, I think. The museum was a government symbol, in a sense, and there was a lot of anti-government feeling, and so people took it out on all of those buildings and institutions which they perceived to be associated with the government.
Around the world, people lamented the wanton destruction of the museum. Lamia describes how Arab friends had a hard time accepting that Baghdadis were responsible for the looting of their own treasures.
Literally, I had a telephone from Algeria to Bahrain, so it's right across the Arab world. People telephoning me and couldn't believe what happened. Everyone had its own theory. Oh, who looted the museum? I started doing statistics. So it depends whom you don't like. Was it the Americans? Was it the Israelis? Was it the Kuwaitis? You know, whoever you don't like. It was so funny. I mean, it's not funny, but it just shows the idea. The one thing, it's sad to say, that they never accused the actual people in Baghdad that they looted it. The seals, they were in the basement storerooms. The basement storerooms, you wouldn't believe. It's like a labyrinth. I know for a whole year I was in the museum in 2003. Every time I went down, I would shout to hear where the people are to follow them, because it's all stacks, and so you don't know where you are. And the seals were in a corner, in small boxes put on top of the cabinets. Okay? How did they find it unless you knew where they are? You can blame anybody. They could be outsiders, but they've heard about them. Or it could be people within the museum. No one was caught because of the museum looting. No one. Not a single person.
When Lamia came to Baghdad, the museum was still in chaos.
You look at all the staff. They were all standing in the lobby, and that was end of May. And they still haven't gone to their rooms. They were in such a state of shock that I remember not a single one of them was able to finish a sentence. It's eerie. If I tell you what you feel, it's eerie, you know. And it was terrible to see it empty like that. But then suddenly you find one thing that has survived and it's still there. Ah, that's fantastic. Even today, now the museum is reopened. And so last May I was going around the museum and seeing some of the objects, which maybe I thought they were looted, you know. But to see them again, it's like seeing friends. It's so nice to see that, oh, this one is still there, you know.
Thanks to the dogged work of Iraqi officials, many thousands of the stolen objects have been recovered and returned to the museum. In February of 2015, the museum was officially reopened for the first time since the American invasion. It has been resurrected, but many objects, like the harvest seal, remain missing. That's why it's important to tell these stories. It can be tempting to treat art like it's something frozen, its meanings embalmed in stone. But what we've heard over the past 2 weeks is different. This Museum of Lost Objects is home not just to the lost artifacts themselves, but to the ways they move so many and continue to carry meaning, even after they're gone.
The Museum of Lost Objects was written and presented by Kanish Tharoor and produced by Maryam Maruf for BBC Radio 4. Our editor is Ruth Gardner. All of these stories are on the BBC News website. There are lots of photos and other bits that couldn't make it on air, but they're all online. Lots of extra stories that you can delve into. Just go to bbcnews.com.